Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
For shits and giggles and for something different, we've clearly gotten started and recording. Should we skip the whole how are you doing this evening and just go from where we are?
Why not?
Hey, actually, on my way home today, guess where I stopped off?
Where? Hop and Grain?
Yep.
Yeah.
Because we got a long weekend coming up and I thought I need to get a brew on this long weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've got myself, what was it? An Irish red ale and an Australian pale ale ready to, well, I've got all the grains and everything ready to go. So I've got a good weekend. Next couple of weekends, brewing away.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I told you, I think we may have mentioned it last time, that me and Riley worked on a couple of brews together.
Yes, you did. Oh, you didn't mention that Riley helped.
Didn't I?
No.
Ah, but I missed out that detail.
I think you said it was Sadie's birthday and you said, oh, speaking of which.
Yes. So it was Sadie's birthday, and in preparation for that and in preparation for a little barbecue I've got coming up in about 3 weeks, we got a couple of brews on. And yeah, Riley helped and she loved it. Like, she got really involved.
Yeah.
And I'll give you a quick rundown on the brew and then I'll tell you the side story. So we made two brews. We put together an American pale ale.
Yep.
And an Australian lager.
Mm-hmm.
And the pale ale has come out amazing. Like, really good. Really, yep. Really good. I honestly can't remember the malt that I used, but the hops was Galaxy and then Citra as a finishing hop. And yep. It's really, really come out well. The lager was, as I mentioned, an Australian lager. And I used Amarillo, I think. And I think I used that as the finishing hop as well. Let me consult my brew journal. Oh, so I used Saz as the finishing hop for that one.
Yeah, okay.
And I also used, actually, so normally I use Saf Ale or Saf Lager. So I did use Saf Ale for the lager. This one I used a Californian lager yeast.
Yeah.
And yeah, the lager's not bad at all. It's pretty good. But yeah, the pale ale turned out really well. It's like one of my best. Unfortunately, I think I didn't have the quick connect from the gas connected properly, so it didn't carbonate. So it was flat come the day of the party. Yeah, which was a bit of a shame, but that's fine. Like, it's all. And you know, I don't know if you've ever done the trick where you quick carbonate by turning up to like 30 or 40 PSI and then rolling it
around. Yeah, I do that all the time.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. I want to have a beer as soon as I fill the keg.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, I've never done that. And I thought about doing it this time, and there was just no room for me to get it out and roll it. So I just cranked it up to like 40 PSI, left it for a couple of hours, and, you know, then came and disconnected the gas and then just let off the head gas.
Yep.
And then just reconnected it back at like my normal 15 PSI and hope for best. And it was a little bit more carbonated than completely flat, but yeah, it still needs, you know, proper carbonation. The lager, on the other hand, was carbonated and is very good. It's just frustrating because it's nowhere near as good as the ale turned out. And also, I don't think Australian lager is for me. So I don't know if I'll do that again.
Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to say before. What's an Australian lager? Foster's.
Well, as we've discussed before, Foster's isn't really Australian, is it? So from what I understand, an Australian lager is a darker, more richer, full-bodied flavoured lager.
Yeah, okay.
Whereas, you know, I kind of consider a lager to be a crisp, clear.
Yeah, clearer, cleaner, yeah.
Yeah.
A bit drier.
Technically, sorry, go ahead.
A bit drier?
Yeah. Technically, if it has hops in it, it's not a lager.
I didn't know that. Yeah, I thought lager was just more about the actual lagering process.
I'll come back to that because that's part of the tangent story I wanted to tell you, which I'll tell you in a minute. And it is technically, but also technically, quote unquote, because nobody cares anymore, but technically it's not a lager if you add hops, which is where Pilsner came from. So the origin of Pilsner was that it was a lager that they added hops to, and that was where it diverged.
Interesting. I thought you were going to say, technically speaking, it's not a lager unless it's brewed in the lager province of South France.
Yeah, otherwise it's just sparkling violence. So let me tell you this side story. So a couple of weeks ago, my mum called and I put Riley on, and Riley and my mum sat for a good half an hour just having a yarn over Signal, just chatting to each other. And they were talking about the brews that we did. Well, they were talking at length about many things, but Riley was explaining to my mum in great detail that she brewed beer and how she did it and what she did and how amazing it smelled. And it was so delicious. You know,
it was delicious. Oh.
I mean, you know, she hasn't actually tried it, obviously, but she's saying it smells delicious. And so, yeah, they were just chatting
before it's fermented.
Well, I mean, I did. but I don't think she'd have liked it. I have made some ginger beer for her, but I haven't given her yet, but I will. Anyway, yeah, so she's talking to my mum and they're having a good old chat and I'm just kind of sitting aside and just letting them go. And yeah, they're getting really into it. And she was explaining to my mum and, you know, and my mum was saying, oh yeah, so, you know, tell them, explain this and what you did and how it works. And she told her in great detail everything that we did and the gravity measurements and everything. You know, she remembers
like
everything.
A sponge.
Yeah. And then my mum said, what beers did you make? She said, well, we made two beers. We made this pale ale and a lager. And my mum said, oh, I don't actually know what the difference is between a pale ale and a lager. And Riley says, oh, it's because it's the yeast. So with a pale ale, it's a top fermenting yeast. And with a lager, it's a bottom fermenting yeast. My mum's just like, yeah, her face was a little bit like that.
You know, it's really funny, kids these days. And I say this to my kids all the time. The stuff that they know and can articulate and can explain, even like before they were in primary school, like before they were 5 years old, I didn't learn half that shit until I was probably in high school or late primary school.
Yeah. Probably. I do know that I knew a lot of stuff when I was a kid that I don't know now.
Oh, but when my daughter was before school, she wanted to do science experiments. So yeah. I was explaining to her the whole, you know, the scientific process about putting together your hypotheses and getting the plan ready and then doing your experiments and testing and comparing that to your hypotheses. So she's going to school at 5 years old talking about hypotheses.
Yeah. Brilliant. That's excellent.
I'm like, I didn't learn that until I was doing science in high school.
Most people don't even learn it then.
No. And it's just one of those things, I think, I don't know, like just the access to information and technology, I think is just, and kids pick it up so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me close off that story. Let me tell you the last part of this. So my mum was asking Riley about the beers and what we did and what we made. And, you know, that she asked that, you know, that Riley explained the difference between a lager and an ale. And then, you know, I can't remember the rest of the conversation exactly, but my mum was asking, you know, well, what did you do? And she was telling her, and she said, yeah, we put the hops in. And my mum said, what hops did you use? And she said, oh, we put Galaxy in the pale ale. And in the lager, we put in Amarillo. And when we were making it, I told Riley that there is a song called Amarillo. And she was like, oh, really? So I put it on, which I don't know if you know this one, but if every pom in the world knows this, it's Show Me the Way to Amarillo by Tony Christie.
No, don't know.
So it was covered for Comic Relief by a comedian from the UK and it got quite famous. So I put that on and Riley absolutely loved it. So of course we listened to that on repeat ad nauseum, which Riley then explained to my mum. Of course my mum knows the song and Riley quite dutifully sang the whole thing for her word for word.
Colourful language in there?
No, not at all. Huh? No.
Oh.
No. But yeah, and then that was the end of that call.
Oh gosh. Little sponges, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how does that segue into relational databases?
So where I was gonna segue was, yeah, little sponges. They're just great at just storing information, aren't they?
In a relational way?
You know what else is
relate that information?
Well, you know what? Kind of, yes, but I think it's more by association. I think that kids have a way of storing data and organizing data in a way that is more efficient for them than a relational database.
Yep. Okay.
Speaking of things that are more efficient than relational databases.
So I guess if you couldn't tell where we're going with this one, Matt, you want to talk about, was it relational databases, data, however you want to pronounce it?
Yeah, I pronounce
databases,
it data. Yeah.
In relation, pun intended, to DDD, is that right?
Yes and no. So I want to talk about the relational data model as a concept.
Okay.
And one of the things that I want to explore in this conversation is DDD, but let's take a step back. So I remember, look, I'm not a DBA. I'm not a database expert. I'm not really much of an expert in anything, but I do have strong opinions about things. And I think it's fair to say that's why many people are here. I don't know. I think we disproved the Matt rant myth. I don't know. But no, as I said, I'm not an expert. But I remember when I first found out about non-relational, I never even thought about it, right? I never even thought about, is there a kind of data model that is non-relational, even though the first databases I have used were, no, the first ones would have been relational because there was some database product we used on the Acorn Archimedes in primary school, and I can't remember what it was. There's no way I'd ever remember that.
Yeah.
But then the database that was most prolific when I became a teenager was probably FoxPro.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say Access.
Then Access.
So I never dealt with FoxPro.
Neither did I, really. And there was several other database programs around, and some of them did have other data models, but Access would be the one that I first really started learning about databases with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Access is, of course, a relational model.
Yep, was. Or is it?
It wasn't until probably 10 years after I left school that I first started, I heard the term NoSQL.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, I know that NoSQL means not only SQL, not SQL.
Interesting. So I just always assumed it meant NoSQL, as in quite literally NoSQL.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. It stands for not only SQL.
There you go. I'm learning something every day.
Yeah.
I think we can leave it there now.
And that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven. No, but I mean, the other thing that's interesting about that is that SQL and relational database models have become synonymous.
Yep.
But SQL is actually supposed to stand for structured query language.
Yep.
And it's supposed to be a database interrogation language. But mm-hmm. SQL and the relational data model have become synonymous.
Yes.
But yeah, when I first heard about NoSQL, I didn't know it meant not only SQL. I thought it meant, and honestly, this was around the time where Facebook, which actually does, of course, run on a relational database, it runs on a very heavily customized MySQL database. But yeah, like a lot of their technologies were starting to take over the web, and a lot of these kind of frameworks that were very anti-enterprise, because, you know, Microsoft dominated everything, right? Of course, Microsoft wasn't the only show in town, certainly not for databases. Like Oracle has always been the biggest, was historically the biggest enterprise database, still mm-hmm. a relational database. But at the time, these emerging technologies felt very anti-enterprise.
Yeah.
And NoSQL, I dismissed NoSQL as a solution in search of a problem and not really being worth my time. And of course, I looked into it a little bit and didn't think much of it more than being quote unquote document databases. So basically just JSON. Yeah. So now, of course, having JSON be columns and being able to interrogate that JSON data in a structured way, again, didn't realize it was doing that. I was just like, well, I can just store JSON in a text column. Why do I care about this? And didn't look into it any further. Interestingly, at the time or around the time, I was working for a company that had a proprietary network monitoring tool. So an SNMP mm-hmm. product. And I remember at one of our quarterly presentations, the head of the development team was doing his segment and talking about what they'd been doing over the past quarter. And he said, and Paul finally got around to building his data storage platform that he's been on at me to let him do for about 2 years. And we've seen X% performance increase and improvements over traditional relational databases and everything's great, blah, blah, blah. I thought, well, that sounds interesting. So I went up to him afterwards and said, you know, what are you doing? And he said, we're actually just storing the data in flat files. I was like, wow, okay. So they're literally storing data in files instead of tables.
Yep.
And they'd indexed it. They'd built their own indexing system for it. And it was highly specialized to the product that it was in use for. And I thought, well, you know, if you can do it and it's worthwhile, great, whatever.
And interesting.
Yeah. I remember
recently, or not recently, but several years back now, Troy Hunt had a post about his Pwned Passwords website. So not Have I Been Pwned, but the Pwned Passwords.
Yeah.
Where you can check if your password has actually been pwned before, right?
Yeah.
And he does it in a way that actually doesn't transmit your password anywhere. So he hashes it and then sends the hash across. And he was talking about the optimizations that he built into that with the help of Cloudflare.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they did, because you can cache flat files.
Yeah.
Right. The data in the file doesn't change. So they just cache them.
Yeah.
And it's just broken up into smaller sets based on your hash, like the first two or three characters in the hash. And it's just got a heap of flat files.
So it doesn't even really need to be indexed in that sense. It's just organized. It's ordered. I mean, that's the thing, when the data is unchanging and it's effectively an archive in that sense, it can be ordered and it doesn't need to be indexed.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, interesting. So either way, at the time, again, it was not something I looked into. When I first started becoming a little bit more interested in non-relational models, it was when I heard about something called Cache. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard of Cache, but it's been around for decades. And it is made by a company called InterSystems.
No.
It's primarily used to support other commercial products of theirs. I don't think it's ever seen much commercial success as a database engine, but they have had bigger success with their other products.
Yeah.
Cache is a hierarchical database. Now, as I said, it's been around for decades, and certainly I think hierarchical databases predate relational databases, unless I'm mistaken. You know, again, look into that. But it was an interesting concept.
Send it to our research department.
That's right. Yeah. But it interested me, and it interested me specifically the way that you write code for it, because the interface was an object model interface. So this means no ORM, like the database platform itself natively supports objects. It was a hierarchical database with an object model API. And I just thought that was fascinating. And I never got much time to look into it more than that. And, you know, certainly from what I understand, the DBAs that worked on it were frustrated about the paradigm shift from the relational model that they're familiar with.
Mm.
But once they got comfortable with it, I think, look, if I can recall, I think the feedback that I got from many people was they had plenty of other frustrations with it, but that aspect of it, they did actually really like. So I thought that was interesting. More recently, and when I say more recently, I really mean probably over the past 3 or 4 years, maybe a bit more than that, I've started to look more into non-relational databases, and I've started to build products around them.
Yep.
Small products, POCs, and not that's not true. I've certainly built some larger scale client products. And in particular, on the mobile side, when I, for one client where I built a sync engine for offline functionality for when you're saving data on your mobile device and you need it to sync and, you know, need it to cache locally if it's offline, resync when it's online.
Yep.
What I was essentially doing was serializing the DTO and storing that as JSON in the local database.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the record was essentially a wrapper around it with an ID and then a sync state and some other metadata. But the actual object itself was serialized as JSON, and I was still able to query and interrogate that without any kind of performance hit. And I started to look into it more, and I started to investigate NoSQL databases a bit more. And I'll be completely honest, I'm absolutely not an expert in databases, SQL or NoSQL or otherwise.
Mm.
But the more I learn about non-relational databases, the more reinforced becomes my opinion that we shouldn't be using relational databases in the vast majority of our products.
Interesting take.
Surely the question on your mind has to be why?
No.
Because I haven't made a case for it. I'm just telling you about where my opinion's gone.
I'm sort of conflating my own opinions and experience on that too. And obviously I've been quite letting you have your say for now. I want to come back to that point. But see, for me, my experience was very similar, right? Starting out with access and getting exposed to relational databases. And, you know, over the years, I know, and I say it these days, that like my brain is now wired to think in object models like that. And I can see data structures. When I'm talking to people now, and I was only doing it this week, I can see what the data structure will look like. And it doesn't, like, I'm at the point now where I know where people will struggle to see what I see. So I need to actually sit down and articulate it and speak and clarify that for them. Now, the reason I'm saying that is I've had experience with data models for a long time. And like you, I am not a DBA. I cannot write an optimized query, I guess. I cannot optimize a database. There are people so much better at that than I am. Now, that being said, 99 times out of 10, yes, SQL relational database is the go-to. And I think that is part of tradition. Now, I do remember back, I'm going to say almost 15 years ago when I was exposed to MongoDB, my first experience with NoSQL databases was a document database.
Yeah.
And the feeling for me around that time was basically everyone, like you said, everyone was going down NoSQL because they were anti-establishment and just let's do something different.
Yeah.
Let's do this because it's cool. It's, you know, the LAMP stack.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right. Like, let's do something different. And I felt at that point that, again, people had the solution and were looking for the problem.
Yeah.
Right. My takeaway from that experience and then moving forward was absolutely, this is, I think, relational databases are the golden hammer that everyone reverts back to.
Yeah.
I think there are certain problems where a document database is the optimal storage mechanism, and there are others where a relational database is. Now, one that we haven't even mentioned is graph databases.
Yeah.
Oh, hesitation there.
Yeah.
But again, graph data structures are good mapping different things.
Yeah. My hesitation there was that I don't really understand the graph model from a database model perspective.
Sure.
So go ahead.
I was going to say, like, the one that really gets to me is I remember looking at one a while back. And basically the example that they gave in the docs was similar to like Facebook, right? Or just a relationship, looking at different relationships. Now, if you have a purely relational model, a relational database, fetching the list of my friend's friends is a very expensive query.
Yeah, yeah.
In a graph database, it's actually extremely cheap.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So it's using the right tool for the right job.
You know what else sounds to me like an ideal use case for a graph database?
What's that?
A layer 3 routing table.
Yeah, absolutely. Because your edges, being the connection between the two nodes, you can add your weights to that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you can absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's all interesting. But probably the most prominent non-relational database in use prolifically in the world today would be vector databases, right?
I don't know. I would say key value stores.
Oh, yeah. Okay. True. Yes. Yeah.
As in Redis being probably the most well-known.
I mean, yeah, you're probably right. I mean, the reason I said vector databases is because obviously that's what large language models are built on.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. 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 Fair enough.
Yeah.
Anyway. It'd be interesting actually to see where we're at with that.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yep.
Anyway, it doesn't sound like I'm raising something that is particularly controversial to you. I think we're kind of, just to call back to our previous episode, we have something of a consensus ad item here.
Yeah. But
at least to an extent.
To an extent. And I think it's, like I said, it's relational is the default hammer that a lot of people go to.
Yeah.
What I have arguments with is when people choose to go NoSQL or a document database because they just want to go anti-establishment, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to be relational.
Okay. So I got two things I want to explore on that. And one is very quick and is 100% in agreement, but I just want to elaborate on it. And the other is where I want to take this conversation next. So I just want to call back to the Atlassian talk we saw at AdaConf last year. So this one was a talk that they gave on their internal developer platform.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they covered it a lot. In many ways, it was kind of an advertisement for the platform because it's not just internal to them. It's a product that you can buy and use as an internal developer platform. But I think one of the key takeaways from me was that what they were saying was that, well, we had some problems in our products arising from the fact that they were built as monoliths. So we decided to rebuild and re-architect as microservices. In order to solve the problems that that introduced, we built this internal developer platform.
Yep.
And that was the key point, right? Was that they didn't have to do that. They could have solved the problems in their monoliths. But the thing is, if they'd have done that, they would have had to have solved those problems. So what they did instead was that instead of solving the problems in the architecture, they solved the problems with architecture. That brought in a different set of problems. And the comparison here for me is that it's what you said earlier, is like, you know, yes, you got to choose the best tool for the job, but whatever you choose, there's going to be trade-offs. There's no perfect solution for anything. If you choose to use a relational database, just with any other decision that you make, there's pros and cons, and you're making sacrifices in favor of benefits. And whichever one you choose, you have to compensate for the cons.
Absolutely.
But, you know, with their example, if you're choosing to go monoliths, you've got problems, you've got to solve those problems. If you choose to go microservices, you're solving those problems, but you're introducing new problems, you have to solve those instead.
Absolutely.
If you, same with your data model. You know, if you choose one model, you are making compromises, you have to solve those. If you choose another one which doesn't have those same problems, it's going to introduce different problems and you're going to have to solve those instead. That's always the case. There's never a solution that you choose that, you know, you make this decision because this is the thing that solves all your problems. You're choosing which problems you want to solve and which problems you want to buy solutions for effectively. And when I say buy, I don't necessarily mean paying for. I mean buying as in
acquiring.
Importing as acquiring. Yeah. Yeah.
And now, I think, the common saying there is there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? That's right. Now, onto the other thing you said, which is that, you know, about the right tool for the job and that, yes, you think that SQL databases are the golden hammer and it's the de facto default that everyone goes for. If, you know, a document DB is the right choice, then that's what you would go for. If SQL is a better choice, that's what you go for. Effectively, that's kind of what I'm paraphrasing, but that's kind of what you were saying.
To an extent, I think, yeah, there's point to be made there, though, is how do you identify what the right use case is and how are you certain you're heading down the right path?
But well, that's
a whole different discussion.
Not really. Like, that is really the main thing that I wanted to discuss, because the more I think about it, the more I think about every project I have worked on over the past 5 or 10 years, the more and more I become convinced that every single one of them would have been better suited to a NoSQL solution. And the more I think about it, the more I realize that the problems that relational databases solve, because yes, they solve problems, they introduce others, but the problems that relational databases solve haven't really been a problem for the vast majority of people for like 20 years.
Yeah.
And not everyone. Like, there are certainly cases where having... Okay, so let's talk about what are the problems that relational databases solve? Primarily two. There are primarily two problems that the relational model solves. There are, you know, more, but primarily there are two, right? One of those is query performance.
Mm-hmm.
The other is referential integrity.
Yeah.
Right.
What about data normalization?
What's the difference between that and referential integrity? That's not what I meant. Sorry. Yes, not necessarily what's the difference, but you're right. Okay. But they come as a package.
They're
really
similar. They come as a pair.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you a question then. Quick aside. How many normal forms are there?
Gosh. Is it 4, 5, 6? I'm going to land on 6.
Okay. What are they called? And what do they mean?
I can't remember now. It's been that long.
You probably can't remember because it's not important to you.
No.
So normalization. I put it to you that normalization, in fact, actually, this is probably the core premise of NoSQL databases, is that normalization is more of a hindrance than a help.
Yeah, kick on.
Now, I'll come back to the referential integrity one. Let's talk about the performance, the query performance one. I just don't think that's a problem anymore. Like, everything is so fast now, especially since we've all started using solid state disk, especially since everything's in the cloud and is, you know, and scalable.
And you've got terabytes of memory.
And you've got terabytes of memory. And don't get me wrong. There are absolutely cases where absolutely optimal query performance is critical and crucial, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that potentially relational databases are not the right solution for those either. I don't actually know, but I think there's a good chance. But that aside, let's say there are use cases, fine. But I don't think that that's the norm, right? And just to get to your point, just to go back to what you said earlier about you don't know how to write and optimize a query. Yeah, neither do I, right? And if the performance optimization was that important, every single one of us on every single project, we would have a DBA writing optimal queries. But we don't. We use ORMs. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. And yeah, you know, sometimes we write code, we write, you know, link queries that generate inefficient or non-performant SQL queries, and we debug and we optimize those. Occasionally, very occasionally, we might even actually write raw SQL, but it's not the norm. And, you know, in my experience, we don't bring in a DBA to do that. And that brings me to my referential integrity point. How often do you have a DBA on your team? Rarely, if ever.
Really, yeah. Right?
And yes, you might define your relationships in such a way that you would expect the database underneath to enforce that referential integrity. But we don't really do that. And we don't have DBAs on the team ensuring that that is the case and ensuring that our databases are structured that way and organized that way and optimized that way. We don't, right? And you know why?
Because we're model first.
We're model first. We do it in our domain. We write aggregates that enforce those rules at the domain layer.
Yep.
And non-relational databases are much more suitable to that use case for that very reason.
Yeah.
Like, an aggregate is a hierarchical model.
Yeah.
Now, granted, depending on how you structure your data model, not your domain model, your data model, you may have to do non-relational queries and you may have to rehydrate things and you may have to do multiple round trips. But chances are your SQL queries that are being generated by EF are doing that anyway.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I want to jump back. When you're talking about, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but almost the false economy of normalization.
Yep.
Is the way I'm going to phrase that. And I remember almost certain, but don't quote me on this, but I think in one of the DDD books, one of the big main ones, the two big main ones, they talk about bounded contexts, obviously.
Yep.
It's a core concept of DDD.
I want to talk about that as well, but yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, and I'm almost certain it actually says, you know, there will be denormalization of your data.
There will be what, sorry?
Denormalization of your data.
100%.
Across bounded contexts.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's up to your application layer. And or maybe you've got some database triggers or whatever else, but there are other ways to keep that data in sync.
100%. Absolutely.
So this is, I guess, to your point around the, like I said, the false economy or the lack of a need for such strict normalization, like, there are other mechanisms to handle it. And it's not the worst thing in the world to say, let's store the same piece of information in two separate tables.
Exactly. Exactly.
Especially when these days, everything or a lot of things, most things are now asynchronously processed in an eventing type situation. So I've got my domain events being triggered around. If I have my shipping order updated event triggered, everyone that wants to know that shipping order got updated can react to it and can store and update their version.
Yep.
And
exactly.
If we're in the world of asynchronous processing, then we are also moving away from the expectation of immediate consistency.
Yes.
And we're moving towards a world of eventual consistency.
Exactly. Exactly. Bingo. Yes.
And if that's the case, then the argument for the data normalization, I think, starts to disappear.
Yes.
Because we know that they're guaranteed to be the same down the track. Maybe not right this millisecond, but they will eventually be consistent. There will be SLAs that say this will be consistent within this specific SLA.
Yes, 100%. 100%. Now, I feel like I haven't even finished stating my case, and I feel like I'm winning you over here. But let me just labor that point a bit more, right? So just following this same line of thinking, I want to explore two aspects of this. First of all, bounded contexts, right?
Yep.
How many projects have you worked on where you've had a database per bounded context?
One major one that I know of.
One, right? Okay. Next question. In all the other projects where you haven't done that, how many of them have you had a DB context per bounded context? Or have you traditionally just gone with the norm and equated a DB context to a database?
More so.
How many projects have you had a schema per bounded context?
Actually, there is one that comes to mind, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, another one.
But it's not the norm, right? And the norm is even when you have in your code and in your domain model bounded contexts defined, it is still quite prolific to normalize your data across bounded contexts, which is, and this is my main problem with this is, I'm going to explore other aspects of this, but just to say it right now, my main problem with relational data model is the way that it forces you to contort your domain model to suit your data storage. That's the problem.
And this you kind of touched on earlier when you made that differentiation between your domain model and your data model.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. And if our database is, if we're in the world of EF particularly, if we are creating our database model first,
yeah,
we end up in that space where we end up making our database structure resemble our entity structure.
No, we end up making our entity structure resemble our database structure.
But that's what we end up first.
We try to be model first, but we have to corrupt and pollute our model to suit our database. Let me give you the classic example.
Yeah.
In a SQL database and or slash in EF, how do you define a many-to-many relationship?
With a joining table.
Hmm. Yep. How many times have you done that?
I can't remember off the top of my head.
It would be tens, yeah. Hundreds, thousands.
Yeah.
How many times has that join table or junction table formed part of your domain model?
Never. Oh, actually, no. Yeah, I guess it does.
It depends. It can. That's why I said how many. Because it absolutely can do, right?
Yeah.
Like if that relationship itself is a domain entity, then fine, yeah. Right? But here's the problem. Let's say you've got a junction table. Let's say you've got an invoices table, and let's say you've got a products table, and then let's say you have an invoice product. This is probably a bad example because that may well be a valid domain entity, right? But for the sake of this discussion, just hear me out, right? This means that now your domain model for an invoice, which should have a list of products, doesn't have a list of products. It has a list of invoice product.
Yes. Yeah. But that's not really a thing. That's not really a domain concept. Yeah. I get where you're going.
Like it might be. Like there are certainly some cases where the relationship itself may belong in your domain. Like particularly if there's metadata around it.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
If it's more than just the two keys.
If it's more than just the two keys, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But otherwise, you have had to pollute your domain model to accommodate your data model. And that is my main problem. Now, just to go back to some of the other problems around this, what we were talking about before around bounded contexts and everything else. One of the most popular architectures that has emerged over the past few years is modular monoliths.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, the concept of a modular monolith is, well, build your monolith so that you get all the benefits of a monolith, but make it modular so that you get all the benefits of potentially being able to split it out to microservices later, yeah. Right? But if you're not building every single one of those modules with its own persistence context, so that it should absolutely have its own at least one, you know, boundary of a bounded context, it should at the very least, have its own DB context, its own schema. But I'm seeing people create quote unquote modular monoliths with one database for the whole monolith with relationships defined between the entities in the modules, because that's efficient. When you write your query for, you know, I want to get this order and I want to get the customer, instead of getting the order, using the customer identity to call the customer module and get the customer from the customer module, it's just being brought back in the database query.
Yep.
How are you then going to split that out?
No, I'm 100% absolutely right. Now, DDD, according to the book, has itself a concept of modules.
Yeah.
Right.
But we're not doing it because we're
not. And we end up in this world, and basically we end up in the back in the world of the big ball of mud, right? Where everything is intertwined.
Yeah.
And what I found is back in the day, right, you had your monolith. And we know the pitfalls of a monolith. Then you go the extreme opposite and you go microservices. And we know the pitfalls of the microservices, right? Like you said before, they all have pros, they all have cons. Just choose which one you'd rather.
Yeah.
Now, then what happened was when people didn't quite get their head around how to do microservices properly, what they ended up with was a distributed monolith.
Yeah.
And in that case, you get all the bad and none of the good.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, what you're
otherwise known as a shit show.
Yeah. And now what you're describing is basically the monolithic microservice.
Yeah.
It's not the distributed monolith. It's the monolithic microservices, where again, you end up with all the bad and none of the good.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I guess what I'm saying here is that I'm not really providing any insights that we don't really have. Like you said, everything that I've described is in the textbooks that have been around for decades, right?
Yeah.
I guess what I'm saying is that the more I've learned about this and the more I've learned about the relational data model that we use, I kind of see how we are accepting compromises and working around things that we don't have to. And that the methodology that we, or any of the methodologies that we follow really, allow us to make these constraints and do all these things that we're using a database that is supposed to do for us, that we're not even using it for, that we're doing in our code anyway. It reminds me of what Scott was saying, Scott Arbeit, about Race. I mean, he was talking about GitHub, right? Or sorry, Git. We were saying that it's a distributed source control system, but everyone uses it on the hub and spoke model. Like, we're not getting any of the benefits of it, and we're getting all the pain. And again, it's like, it's the same point he's making. He's not kind of discovering something new here. He's just saying, we're not using this for the benefits that it provides. Therefore, why are we suffering the pain that it gives us? Just to get back to the point I was making about the many-to-many relationships, and just to be a bit of an apologist on this one, because I've done it, and I'm sure many people do. If you open up the docs for EF Core many-to-many relationship, here we go, here it is. Many-to-many relationships modeling. Let me just drop this in the chat. I want you to have a look at this and tell me what it says.
A user when there are a number of entities of one entity type is associated with any number of entities of the same or another entity type. Yep.
Yeah.
For example, a post can be associated with many tags, and each tag can be in turn be associated with many posts. Yep.
So if you scroll down to their first, so they've got a little SQL.
Create snippet. Table post tag. Now that is not.
Scroll down. Forget the SQL example.
Yep.
But look at the C# example, right? So let's assume you've got a domain entity that's a post, domain entity that's a tag, but then you've got your post tag, and the post has a list of post tags, and the tag has a list of post tags. Anyway, if you keep going, and then there's the examples, and then there's the basic many-to-many.
But a post in this instance, a post tag is not really a domain concept.
I know. So this is where I'm going. Basically, I'll cut to the chase here because I'm doing kind of what I'm accusing them of doing. They buried the lead. Like, if you scroll down, basically, this way of doing it, you had to do with Entity Framework. But with EF Core, you don't have to do that anymore because you can use the named join table without it actually having DB set in your DB context.
Yeah, okay.
So you don't actually have to create your post tag class.
Yep.
You can just do it in the database level. And I think part of the problem here is that with Entity Framework, you couldn't do it that way. You had to have the post tag class, and you had to have that in your DB context. You don't need that anymore. And I think they buried the lead. Kind of show you, well, this is how you can do it. Then you scroll down, it's like, this is how you should do it. So it's kind of like they said the quiet part out loud. So that's my kind of semi-apologist bit. It's like, even the docs don't prioritize the quote unquote right way.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, that's it. Like, I guess in summary, that's my main, look, I have lots of gripes, you know, one of them being about how it encourages bad behavior and bad modeling, and, you know, and it encourages bad coupling.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all problems. My main gripe, though, is the fact that it forces you to pollute your domain model. Because, like, this is one example, but there's other examples as well.
Yes, absolutely, 100%. So this is one example. Then we've also spoken about the issues you have with the modular monolith, right, where you're sharing your domain context, your DB context across multiple bounded contexts and domains. But just to, I guess, you know, I'm not in disagreement with you at all here. I think I agree quite a lot. But just also to play devil's advocate here too, just because there is a technically better way to do something does not mean that that has to be the only way to do it or that is the right way to do it. And by that, I mean, as solution architect, we need to take into account a lot more than just what is the most technically appropriate way to do something.
Yeah.
Right? What are the costs involved? What's the support mechanisms like? Does your company have the capability to support a MongoDB database?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And, you know, like the number of projects I've worked on where I've spoken to the client and we've looked at the different database options available and we've ended up using SQL for no other reason than the fact that they have a SQL cluster, which they have licenses for, which is managed by a team of DBAs and admins who back it up and have all the other controls in place around data protection and monitoring and everything else. And for that reason, above anything else, yep,
it's the right tool for that job.
Yeah. And, you know, I think in light of, not in spite of, but in light of everything that I've said, we, and in fact, this is just echoing back what you said, we as solution architects and software developers should be able to use that tool, and we absolutely can. And my problem isn't that SQL is wrong or prevents you from delivering the right solution or the right product. It's that it doesn't guide you to the pit of success as well as other models do.
That I agree with. I do agree with that. I was going to add, like you did, you also mentioned it earlier, especially Microsoft SQL Server. The native JSON handling built in is a lot better now than it used to be.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is a lot more encompassing and can actually handle the situations you're talking about here a lot better too.
Yeah.
Than it used to be able to.
Yeah.
And back to that point that if the organization, if the enterprise has a team of Microsoft SQL DBAs with their SQL cluster, then why would you rock the boat?
Yeah. Yeah. Agree. Yeah. Yeah. Like this isn't a rant on SQL. This isn't a diatribe against SQL. And I'm not now joining the anti-SQL militia. You know, I
need that sticker on my laptop.
Yeah.
I need someone to design an anti-SQL militia sticker.
Let's get some printed up for Adacomp or for our beers. But yeah, like I'm not waving the flag of the anti-SQL militia. I'm not protesting outside the next SQL conf, you know, waving a gun or anything. Like I don't have that big a problem with it. What I said at the start was that the more I think about it, the more I have realized that nearly every project I've worked on over the past probably 5 years, if not more, would have been better suited to a non-relational model.
I think I agree with that. And the more I'm digging into it, the more I'm digging into, I guess, to the DDD mindset.
Yeah.
Like an aggregate route could neatly fit into a document structure.
Absolutely. And I've done that.
And yeah, a discussion, I think I mentioned it last time with you or recently with you, that an avenue I'd love to explore and I really want to as soon as I find some spare time and if someone wants to hit me up about it is digging into using an actor framework like Microsoft Orleans in that space.
Yeah.
And having each actor being your aggregate route or your aggregate, I should say. So because I think there's a natural synergy behind an aggregate or one, I'm just trying to think what the technical definition that they use, but basically it's like a transaction scope almost.
Yeah.
Is one way to think about it. But an aggregate and an actor or a grain in Microsoft Orleans, I think there's a really good synergy there. And again, maybe they're like, let's explore what's the right tool for the right job.
It's kind of almost the ultimate expression of encapsulation in that it contains the data as well as the knowledge of how to work on that data.
Yeah.
But, you know, like just literally today, and this wasn't the inspiration for this because this has been on my mind for years now. And some of the concrete examples that I've used today have, you know, these have not been recent things, but literally today, and this actually happened to me today, I was working on a project, and this is a SQL project. And this is a project where I selected the database and I selected SQL, and I did it for specific reasons, which were not related to the suitability of the data model to the domain model. It was an unrelated decision, and it was the right one for other reasons that we've discussed. But literally today, I was working on a feature, and I was defining a many-to-many relationship from a table to itself, okay? So yep. There's a relationship between this entity and other entities, right? So think of it like using your example earlier of friends in a graph, right?
Yeah.
So imagine if this table of people was users or friends, and they needed a way of defining relationships of themselves
to
themselves.
To the same data type, yeah.
Yeah. Now, that probably would warrant an actual entity for that relationship, because that entity is probably represents part of the domain. So it's a bad example. But in my case, it didn't. Like, there was literally no reason to have anything in here apart from a list of other related entities of the same type. There was no metadata other than this. So I did it, and I defined the relationship, and I did it using a junction table defined in my entity type configuration, not as a standalone entity. And I had some problems with it, and I tweaked it, and eventually I got it to work, right? And I got it to work by setting the cascade behavior to no action.
Yep.
And I thought about it, and I thought, well, that's wrong, because that doesn't represent what should happen here. And I spent probably 2 or 3 hours jumping through hoops, tweaking it, writing tests, trying to get the tests right, trying to get the model right. And after 2 or 3 hours, I stopped and I took a step back and I said, why do I care so much about this? Like, first of all, I haven't even implemented the delete feature in the product yet.
Right.
Like, this is very much future Matt's problem.
Yagni.
Second of all, sorry?
Yagni. You've never come across Yagni?
Oh, Yagni. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Sorry, I couldn't hear you. It's not that I didn't know the term. Yeah. Oh. Absolutely. Like, why was I spending so much time on this? And second of all, I just thought, like, I've literally written domain rules that prevent or enforce this behavior the way I want it. Why do I give a fuck what the database is doing?
Mm.
I don't.
Yep.
So I rolled the behavior back, deleted all the tests that tested the constraints in the database, and just I already had unit tests that did it at the domain level anyway.
Mm.
Like, problem solved. It's literally happened today. True story.
I guess that just makes the assumption, though.
Yeah.
That your application is the only thing manipulating the data.
Yep, it does. It does make that assumption. Yes.
Absolutely. And again, like going back to compromises and pros and cons and just understanding the entire scenario we're in.
Yeah.
You have to make that conscious decision. Okay. If we're going to move that logic from the database into the application layer, then we need to be comfortable with the fact that the application layer is the only thing doing that data manipulation.
Yeah, look, you're absolutely right, 100%. I wrote an architecture decision record to that effect. So yeah. I documented that decision along with those pros and cons and trade-offs and why I'd accepted it and chosen to do that. So absolutely, 100%. Agree, right? And I think, again, my problem here, and just to, I think, to really frame my fundamental issue here, right? My problem is that using SQL didn't cause that problem, because after 2 or 3 hours of wasted time, I literally deleted that problem and moved on with my life, right? It didn't, like, it wasn't the problem. What caused the problem was what you said right at the start, which was that you now think in data models. That's the problem, right? Because you should be thinking in domain models. But that aside, I was thinking in data models as well. And the problem is that I was using a SQL database, and therefore my mindset was, well, I have to ensure that my SQL database is set up with the right constraints and rules to do what it's supposed to do to enforce the rules as I see them. And that's the problem. I didn't have to do that.
You were thinking through the lens of your golden hammer.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
Just keep using that term, right?
Yeah.
Because we have all been conditioned to relational databases are our default data store.
Yeah.
Right. Doesn't mean that we're not aware that there are other forms. And, you know, we all know, okay, yes, there are other data structures, there are other database types. And yes, there are certain situations that those databases serve, but our default will always be a relational database is the structure that we use. Much like object oriented software is a default for us.
Yeah.
As opposed to functional programming.
Yeah.
Absolutely, there are scenarios where functional programming is the more ideal solution, but that's not my default.
Yeah.
Because that's not the way that my brain has been wired after 20, 25 years in this industry.
That's it, right? Is it, we tend to think, okay, I'm going to use a relational data model unless someone can give me a good reason not to.
Exactly.
Instead of thinking, putting time and effort into the decision, what data model should I choose?
Yeah, but I said it before too, right? The decision, it's not just what's the most technically appropriate solution.
No,
we also need to think about the ongoing maintenance and the life cycle and lifespan of the whole solution.
Let me rephrase. I don't disagree. We do need to make that decision conscientiously. But my point is we do need to make that decision as opposed to not making that decision and just .NET new.
Absolutely.
SQL, EF Core, done.
And that comes back to what you just mentioned just before, your architectural decision register.
Yeah.
Documenting it down, documenting why you went down that path, what you've chosen, and the pros, the cons, and all the decision matrix that actually went into going down that path.
What compromises you've acknowledged that you will accept and
Correct.
How you're going to mitigate them.
Correct.
Well, that was not the hard sell that I thought it was going to be.
I don't think so. I mean, it's funny because I've had that mindset for a long time, but still almost 100% of the products, projects, solutions I've built have been on a relational database.
Yeah.
Even though in the back of my mind, I still have there are problems where a different data structure or a different database will serve better.
Yeah.
I still end up in the lowest friction, the lowest, the default almost. Of relational just seems to work here.
The funny thing is, you're going to come away from this conversation now, and every time you start a new project, you're going to be looking at it thinking, fuck, I got to use freaking SQL for this, and that's going to screw with my aggregate roots and my domain model, and
you're
going to
be
frustrated.
You say that, but you know what? .NET Aspire has made it easier and lowered the friction to trying out different database models.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
That because reminds me. It's as simple as one or two lines, and I can drop in a MongoDB database and work against that instead of worrying about do I have to have my SQL database installed? Do I have to download, install, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah.
It's actually so much easier to experiment and test out the different database structures.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. The first thing is that just, again, going back to our modular monolith, or even really our different bounded contexts, but it might be a bit much, but certainly for modular monoliths, you absolutely should be able to use a different database engine and a different data model for different 100%. Modules. Absolutely.
And that's right? The whole point. Like, that's the point of your different bounded contexts, right?
Yeah.
They are completely separate. They should not be entangled. They should not be influenced from each other.
Yeah. And then the other thing, just to add on to what you were just saying, is even DDD aside, just thinking from a clean architecture perspective and thinking about that in the sense of lowercase clean architecture, like unequivocally from uppercase clean architecture, but even more generically, your domain model should be completely agnostic of your data model. So you should be able to have your domain run on any persistence platform, but that's not the way that we design them.
No. And it's interesting. I remember a friend of mine who I really want to get onto this podcast, and we need to, a long time ago, asked me one question that still sticks into my mind when you say, okay, we've built this application. It's, you know, we've got this database agnostic layer, and you've spent all this time architecting everything. And he's like, how many times have you taken a production application and changed the database layer? None.
Yep.
Right. The answer is zero. I'd say 90%, more than 90% of projects and products out there, the database technology, you're not lifting and shifting that out.
So we've brought this up before, and I agree that I think it is the weakest argument for clean architecture. But there are some caveats. First of all, I have worked in orbit of product. I've never done it, right? I have actually. I have worked on one project where we've swapped out the database. In fact, not as a developer, but on the infrastructure side, I've worked on one where we switched from Oracle to SQL, and that was cost-driven. I won't even go into that one. And then there was the one I mentioned earlier where they moved from, so I think they were using MySQL for that monitoring platform, I think, or it might have been SQL Server, but it was a SQL relational database and they switched to that flat file. So it does happen. But that aside, I have to wonder is the answer to that zero because of how tightly coupled our data models are to our persistence engine, even when we use something like clean architecture and we say, oh yeah, you know, our domain is decoupled from any external concerns. But actually, it's not. Even if from a technology perspective, and even if you don't have package dependencies on a specific database engine or driver or anything like that, if your domain model is modeled based on your data model, then your domain model is coupled to your persistence engine.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's, if you are designing your application layer, your domain model, to have its, I don't want to say database agnostic, but to have its database layer, its infrastructure layer completely stripped out and replaced by a completely random different technology, almost suggests that you have gone into building this project out knowing that you are going down the path of using subpar technology.
How do you mean?
Well, why wouldn't I just build it for the best that's available, right? If I'm building for best-in-class database data storage,
yeah,
then I don't care that I need to change it out. Why would, right, I want to change it out if I'm using best-in-class?
I don't think that that's the right way of looking at it, right? So if your domain model says that, yeah, if you have an aggregate route which has to be responsible for invariance and for ensuring the internal consistency of the aggregate, the entity, so on and so forth, database has nothing to do with it. In fact, the whole thing should operate completely independently in memory alone without a database.
Absolutely. I guess my point there, though, is, or what I'm trying to say is, right, if today Microsoft SQL is the best choice for a database,
uh-huh,
for whatever application I'm building,
right,
why would I build it in a way that we need to strip that out and change it, knowing everything I know right now, right? If I've made the architectural decision to say my Microsoft database is the most appropriate database to use, why do I need to go and build it in a way that says, oh, tomorrow we can strip that out and stick in a MongoDB?
Yeah, no, you don't. You don't have to, and you shouldn't, right? But what you should do is you should make a decision, and you should say that we are accepting some compromises here. These are the compromises that we're accepting. The way that we're building this now means that if in the future we wanted to move away from SQL, these are the changes we would have to make. But we're doing it now because to architect around not having to do those changes would cost three times as much for no immediate benefit. But by documenting this decision now, it means that in the future, anyone who else who comes along and builds on top of this should also see that decision and also either not make those compromises or make similar compromises and document them conscientiously,
yeah,
or not. But more importantly, the why is that, let's say tomorrow LiamDB launches and it's five times as fast as SQL, 20 times as scalable, and costs a penny for every dollar, you'd be pretty fucked off if you couldn't move to it, right? Now, granted, that's a big what if. And, you know, frankly, if that happens, you would have to say, well, what's the TCO over 3 years? You know, it might save us 99 cents on the dollar, but it's actually only costing us $10 a month. So who cares? Or, you know, or you might say, we're spending thousands a month on this database. We do want to move. I don't know, but you'd have to evaluate it and certainly weighed against the cost of what it's going to take to re-architect it and move it and migrate the data, as well as redoing the model and so on and so forth. But my argument is that compromise, it shouldn't be in your domain. It shouldn't be in your domain model.
Correct. It's in your infrastructure layer, right? That's the point of the infrastructure layer.
Yeah.
And we've said this before, your domain model is not the same thing as your data model.
Yeah. Right? Except in 99% of projects, it is.
Correct. And there's nothing saying that they can't be the same, right? They're allowed to be the same thing, but you do need to be aware that they are two different concepts.
Yeah. And I think we're circling the same point here, but it just goes back to what we said before, which is that I'm not saying don't use this or do use that. I'm saying make an active decision in it rather than not thinking about it and just choosing what is considered the default. Well, I think we have pretty much run out of things to say on this topic, which is probably a good thing because they're calling last orders. So we got to get out.
So then, Matt, I think that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Oh. automation.
And what we've been doing, instead is building up a backlog and then having 2 or 3 weeks off just because we need the fucking time off.
Yes.